This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, May 2nd, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. The president has touched off another day of American history lessons with his version of the facts of Andrew Jackson's presidency. Perhaps more critically, though, in Washington, President Donald Trump touched off a second straight week of frenzied congressional whipping by saying that the House was ready to pass the latest version of his health care bill. The first try failed, but Republicans know that they and the president ran on repealing the Affordable Care Act. But they're also confronting a historical fact of their own. This one's about Obamacare. As unpopular as parts of that law are, there are other parts that voters really, really like. When the president struck his latest deal with House conservatives, they seemed to gut one of those very popular protections, the one that says insurance companies can't refuse to sell you coverage or charge you more if you have a pre-existing condition. There was plenty of spin around this deal all over Washington. The president was asked to explain his position on CBS's Face the Nation.
When I watch some of the news reports, which is so unfair, and they say we don't cover pre-existing conditions, we cover it beautifully. Although, I'll tell you who doesn't cover pre-existing conditions: Obamacare. You know why? It's dead.
In one of the fixes,
it's not going to be here.
In one of the fixes that was discussed, pre-existing was optional for the states.
Sure, in one of the fixes, and they're changing it.
Oh, okay.
And changing.
So it'll be permanent.
Of course.
Okay. This
is a development, sir.
So you're saying it's going to be pre-existing for everybody?
This has evolved over a period of 3 or 4 weeks.
Now, last week, the president said a vote was imminent on his health care deal. House Republicans frantically tried to find the votes, while their staffers told reporters to ignore that artificial deadline that came from the White House. Then the White House talked up another vote this week, and then by Monday, here was White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer.
We're getting closer and closer every day, so I would assume that today we were closer than we were a week ago. But we're not there yet, and that decision is going to be wholly within the Speaker, the Majority Leader, and the Whip to let us know when they're going to open that vote up.
So lots of mixed messages and plenty of confusion. We want to find out where things stand. And more importantly, what do consumers need to know about the future of their coverage as Republicans struggle to find the votes for it? Mary Agnes Carey is partnerships editor and senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She says the latest debate over pre-existing conditions is about state flexibility and also about how much consumers will wind up paying.
It gives states flexibility to find other ways to provide health insurance for people. Here's what I mean. If a state can go to the federal government and say, we have a different method to reduce premiums or increase enrollment or increase choice, they can provide a variety of different things for coverage. They can waive these essential health benefits, the things we know that are required in the Affordable Care Act, maternity care, prescription coverage rather, hospital coverage, that sort of thing. But if you had a coverage lapse, you had 63 days where you didn't have health insurance, that's where the pre-existing issue comes in, because states could, if you had that break in coverage, charge sicker customers more, but they'd have to create these high-risk pools. They'd have to provide funds to insurers to help cover some of the high-cost cases. That's where the pre-existing issue comes in, and that's where the concern is.
So it's not necessarily that people with pre-existing conditions wouldn't have access to coverage. I mean, we've got this old issue of access. It's just they may pay tens of thousands of dollars. The insurance companies could charge whatever they want.
Well, that's the big issue, right? If they go in and experience rate, they look at, well, my goodness, you've had cancer, or you've had a heart condition, or you have another chronic condition. That's where they can start to charge more. That's where this idea of a high-risk pool, you segment off the sickest individuals, that could lower the health insurance premiums for healthy people. But in that high-risk pool, that's where you could have some problems with rates, with coverage, with all these changes that people are worried about.
High-risk pools have been tried in lots of states in the past, Mary Agnes, and they are great for those younger and healthier people because it gets the older and sicker people out of your insurance pool. Have they worked in the past in places where they've been tried?
Well, they're often underfunded. Individuals are often charged really high premiums, and they've had waiting lists. And so those three things together have become a problem for the high-risk pool because you know that you are insuring the sickest people. That's where the pause is. You've had some instances where they've had some success, but generally they have had all those problems. Again, not enough money. People have to pay a very high premium. And you might have a waiting list before you can get coverage or a waiting period before the coverage starts. you know, that's not something people really like.
So we should remind people that if this deal gets to the floor, this is just a small part of the larger Republican health care deal that we've been reporting on for a month or two. There are still the cuts to Medicaid in there. There are still the proposed tax credits for people to buy health insurance. But with this new deal, Mary Agnes, such as it is, what would this mean, say, for the average 50-year-old person with diabetes who's trying to shop for insurance on the individual market?
Let's say you live in a state like California that embraced the Affordable Care Act. They have their own health insurance exchange. It's vibrant. It's working. You will probably not be harmed by this at all. But if you were in a more conservative state that didn't embrace the Affordable Care Act, maybe Texas, you were on the federal exchange, and that state government went to HHS and said, we have a plan to cover our individuals that will satisfy all the criteria on premiums and enrollment and choice, that is where you, as that 50-year-old with diabetes, might be looking at all of a sudden your option is a high-risk pool. Or you may find yourself with a policy that is perhaps more expensive and doesn't provide the coverage you need. But again, we should say that as part of this waiver requirement, letting states take this alternative approach, they are supposed to put in mechanisms to help provide people with coverage, possibly help those insurers with the highest cost cases. A lot of this will depend on how it's implemented at the state level, but you could see very different scenarios depending on where you live.
So that 50-year-old person with diabetes, we just talked about their health care and their insurance premium. Mary Agnes, they are also voters. Does this thing even go to the floor? Does it have the votes?
I think this is the calculation that's happening right now. Number one, it seems like as of this moment, no, they don't have the votes. But if you are a member of Congress who campaigned to repeal the Affordable Care Act, if that was a pillar of your campaign, and for many Republicans, it was, and in practice it has been, because the House has voted more than 60 times to repeal this law. You could take the stance as a House Republican, this isn't perfect, I know the Senate's going to change it, I've got to get the process moving, and I want to move it forward. I think that's one calculation. The other calculation is exactly the point that you are talking about. A member has to look at their district, their constituents, and explain what this means for them. Many of these same members who said they want to repeal the Affordable Care Act have said they don't want anyone to lose coverage. So if this particular version of the bill creates that problem, if people are going to lose their health insurance or they will be charged more, that sort of thing is also problematic.
And another calculation, does a member want to vote for a bill that may not ever become law? They call that in politics walking the plank. And if that bill is polling at 20 or 17%, the answer for many of them may be no. Mary Agnes Carey, partnerships editor and senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, if things sound chaotic and uncertain around kitchen tables in America and on the House floor when it comes to health care, imagine what it's like in the boardrooms of the insurance companies who have billions of dollars riding on the outcome here. Dr. Carolyn McClanahan is a physician and a financial planner who advises on healthcare policy, and she's here. Dr. McClanahan, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Boy, if there's one thing that insurance company CEOs love, it's uncertainty.
Oh, the insurance market hates uncertainty. They have to deal with it enough with healthcare issues.
So there has been uncertainty all through the negotiation and the implementation of Obamacare. That's not new. But now we have this situation where Republicans elected on repeal have been really going in fits and starts across Pennsylvania Avenue, pronouncements from the president, repeal is coming, we have the votes, we don't have the votes. What does this do to insurance companies, their ability to plan, and just their ability to sleep at night?
Well, it kills their ability to plan. And actually, this started with the election when they didn't know what President Trump was going to do with especially the cost-sharing subsidies, which is a huge thing that he's holding over their head right now. You know, would they continue fighting for those cost-sharing subsidies? So that uncertainty has encouraged a lot of the insurance companies to basically just leave the markets.
Cost-sharing subsidies, that's money under Obamacare that goes to insurance companies to encourage them to insure low-income people. It's sort of separate from the deal we were just talking about with Mary Agnes Carey. It's a whole other part of this. You know, it struck me, Carolyn McClanahan, there's been surprisingly little public lobbying and high-profile positioning from the insurance company lobbyists here. Nothing like with the Affordable Care Act so many years ago. Why is that? Why are they hanging out in the background?
Well, I think they really have no control right now. And either way, they're going to come out okay. Because with the Affordable Care Act, everybody talks about how, oh, the ACA policies are losing money. But that's just that line of product for the insurance companies. They have other lines, the group insurance, you know, so the large markets, the Medicare Advantage plans, that where they are making billions of dollars. In fact, Aetna just announced record profits. And so it's the one line that's losing money. So if all these rules change, they're going to be much more favorable for insurance companies. So there's no reason for them to make a ruckus because they're still going to be okay.
And it's hard to remember sometimes that this whole debate over the repeal of Obamacare, it's the individual market. It's a pretty small part of the market. It's actually not that many people when you look at the overall size of the healthcare industry. Most of us get our insurance through our employer.
That's exactly right. And, you know, one of the things that people don't understand of what's going on through the healthcare law right now is that they're talking about changing essential benefits, not only in the small market, but in the large market. So for people who think, oh, this isn't going to touch me, it's just going to touch those small people who are insured by the ACA or through Medicaid, they're wrong. We're going to see major upheaval in the entire insurance market.
Do insurance companies really want to return to underwriting the kinds of policies that lets them carve out the sicker and older people, sort of the bad old days that everyone used to hate before Obamacare? They get this flexibility to cherry pick, and that's profitable. But with that comes some pretty lousy PR, I would think.
It does. And so it's a landmine for them. I think that they would like to see us decide on something and stick to it as long as they're going to make good money. And the problem in this country is we've never answered a basic question, and is that should everybody be covered? And one of the things I complain about all the time is both parties focus on insurance coverage, where, you know, in our country, we pay $10,000 per person per year for health care, and other countries pay less than half of that. And part of it's because we're so inefficient. So why aren't the politicians focusing on what makes our health care so expensive? And that would bring down insurance costs.
You know, Carolyn McClanahan, it makes me wonder also whether insurance company CEOs, when they sit back and look at this, really think Obamacare is ever really going to go away, do they?
I don't think so. But, you know, one of the things I've learned, especially with the Trump election, you never say never. So who knows what's going to happen?
Well, they are paid to predict risk in your health care and maybe also their own risk in the insurance market with billions of dollars at stake. Insurance companies, CFOs and CEOs are sitting back and watching this debate and trying to decide where the money is in the House and Senate. Dr. Carolyn McClanahan, physician, financial planner, healthcare policy expert, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today in for John Hockenberry. Texas was rocked by violence on Monday. A paramedic and a civilian were shot by a Dallas gunman who was found dead later that day. At the University of Texas, Austin, a student attacked his classmate with a knife, killing one and injuring three others before the suspect was taken into custody. Meanwhile, precise details are still emerging on the latest police shooting of an unarmed black teenager. Over the weekend, a police officer in the Dallas suburb of Balch Spring shot 15-year-old Jordan Edwards through the passenger side window of a car he was riding in. Police responded to calls of underage kids at a house party, and as they arrived, the cops reportedly heard gunshots and came upon a car containing Edwards and his friends. As the car pulled away, an officer fired several rounds from his rifle into the car, hitting Edwards in the passenger seat. He was later pronounced dead at the hospital. Now, police have not released the name of the officer, though he is on administrative leave. Noman Merchant is with the Associated Press, and he's covering the story in Texas. Noman, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Todd.
We should review the facts of the case. I had a few of them there, Noman. Officers responded to a house party, and then there was a great deal of debate as to whether the car that Jordan was riding in was approaching police or driving away.
Yes, there was. Police originally on Sunday, the day after the shooting, said that police officers were threatened by a car reversing toward them, and one officer opened fire. Their original statement talked about the vehicle backing down the street toward the officers in an aggressive manner. The attorneys for the family of Jordan Edwards questioned that narrative, and shortly after they held a press conference on Monday afternoon, Balch Springs' police chief came out and said that his review of the video contradicted what they had said the day before, and that actually the vehicle was driving away when the officer opened fire.
And so more details now, because there's body camera footage. What do we know about the actual shooting? The car was driving away. Do we know where the officer was situated in relation to the car or why he may have fired? Do we know any more details from the street?
According to the family attorney, Lee Merritt, the gunshots from the officer who fired entered through the front passenger side window, striking Jordan. We don't know from the police department why the officer may have opened fire or really what the video showed, other than the vehicle driving away and not reversing toward the officers as the police originally claimed. The police department so far has refused to turn over the video or even identify the officer involved or speak to his potential motive or what he might have been thinking when he opened fire with the rifle.
And so that means that there's also no indication of whether Jordan Edwards was targeted specifically in the shooting as somebody who the officer may have thought had a weapon or something like that, or whether there was just random shooting into a car.
Well, Lee Merritt, the family attorney, says that Jordan and the four teenagers in the vehicle with him were not carrying weapons, and there was no evidence that they had any sort of alcohol in the vehicle. Keep in mind that the original complaint was related to underage drinking. It was, according to witnesses, a pretty chaotic scene with lots of people on the street, and Jordan and these four people were trying to leave the party as it was getting a little bit dangerous, and particularly as police were arriving.
Well, we're going to talk about overall community police relations in Dallas and the suburbs in just a minute, Noman. But first, what do family and friends say about 15-year-old Jordan Edwards? What kind of kid was he?
He was a high school freshman in the Dallas suburbs, a good student, an athlete, someone who is very popular, someone well-known. And as you've alluded to, his story has taken on already a broader resonance than just the people in the Dallas area. It's something that's getting a lot of attention because of its similarities to other examples of police shootings involving unarmed black men.
And overall, outside of this case, I mean, these cases happen all too often, and they've been part of an ongoing narrative in this country, as we all know. A tragic case with a 15-year-old like this tends to highlight broader issues and long-running issues between communities and police. What has that situation been like in Dallas? Has there been any improvement over the last 18 months or 2 years?
Well, speaking to Balch Springs in particular, the police chief on Monday said repeatedly how sad he felt and how he couldn't understand, just from a personal level, the pain that Jordan's family is going through, though he had met with the family multiple times. And Lee Merritt, in speaking to me, credited the police chief for trying to make a good faith effort now to, you know, correct the record from the mistaken statement from Sunday. But he also said that in this case, there's really only one conclusion that the family can see happening, at least with the police department, and that's the firing and charging of this officer who was involved. The bottom line, I think, is that people are well aware of some of the issues between police and the public in Dallas and nationally, and I think they're waiting to see more action and they're calling for more action. There was a vigil last night, and there are talks of more protests through the week as this case moves forward and the local district attorney's office and the local sheriff's office investigate it.
And have the police given any indication of how quickly their investigation might move? Certainly there's going to be plenty of public pressure for some quick decisions here.
Yeah, there will be a lot of pressure. It's already building. The police chief yesterday called for calm and for time to allow the investigation to move forward. The sheriff's office said yesterday that it was in the preliminary stages of its investigation. Typically something like this, if it were to go to a grand jury, we're talking in the range of months and not days or weeks. But that said, I think the public pressure here may end up pushing forward some action, but it is going to take some time to get everything to come out and to make a full determination as to exactly what happened here and why this officer opened fire.
The case of 15-year-old Jordan Edwards shot dead by police riding in the passenger side of a car in the suburbs of Dallas over the weekend. Noman Merchant with the AP. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chicago reached a disturbing milestone a few days ago 1,000 victims of gun violence so far this year. Who picks up a gun and why in Chicago? That's a question that our friends at WBEZ are asking in their new series. It's called Every Other Hour. That's how often someone's been shot in Chicago over the last 15 months. In this next story, 19-year-old Jaime recounts how he first got involved in gang violence in Chicago and how at age 15, he was involved in his first gang shooting. Today, he lives with his mom in Pilsen and he works as a busboy. Here, Jaime explains how he went from being a middle school stoner to a gang shooter, and there is some strong language here.
At first, I wasn't going to bang, to be honest. I remember exactly how it happened. On Friday night, we all got drunk. I was like, 13 or something? And then I came home late as hell, like at 3. My mom, she was so mad. Like, she did not want me to go out Saturday night. That night, all my friends ended up, like, my closest friends, the people I grew up with since I was 3 years old, they all turned the same gang. So I was just like, damn. Unless, you know, on Monday, I end up turning out. Because going to her school, the Ambrose were messing with me. And my boy Shady and my boy Darkness were like, bro, what they think you're? Might as well turn. And, like, in my head, I was like, why not? So I just ended up turning out. I got my violation. I took it like a champ. I was in the basketball court, and my ops came into the park, and then I seen a dude up a gun, and then the other guy had a gun, so it's like I had two guns just pointed at me, and then they're all like, let's smoke them already, let's smoke them. So I dip. So as soon as I started dipping, like literally in like 3 seconds, they just started firing. Doom, 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 like nonstop. After all that happened, it turns out a girl got shot an inch away from her heart. I caught the guy like a month later driving in my neighborhood. So I flagged him and he jumped out. I was so mad that he almost killed me. And I was so mad that he shot a girl. So it's like, she didn't deserve to get shot. And I deserve to get shot. So it's like, my time is my time. So I just ran up on him and we just started fighting there, bro. But it got to the point where like, I couldn't stop. Like, he ended up on the floor and I just kept stomping on him. And like, he got up and then he just fell out. Like, he just fell out, bro. And like, there was so much blood on the floor, bro. Yeah, I was 15 when I first shot my first gun. And that's how I earned my nickname, Trigger. That's why, like, at first they were gonna call me Trippy because, bro, I used to stay high, bro. Like, I just probably smoke like 80 a day. But yeah, they were going to call me Trippy. And then after that, one of my old school seeing how I was shooting, he's like, you're a shooter, bro. Like, you got it in you, bro. Like, you got that aim. It was Memorial Day too, bro. That's all I'm going to say, Memorial Day. And that day, bro, like, somebody, like, the OGs wanted one of the shorties to go handle business. Nobody wanted to do it. They're like, you do it. I was like, man, I'll do it. Like, I want to do it. Come on, let's go. So they gave me the pole, and I took one of my homies with me. I was like, come on, let's walk. Bro, I had a 357, bro. I never seen a gun that big, bro. Freaking handgun. I was like, what the dude? This the size of my thigh, bro. I didn't know what to do with it. I was like, I'm going to break my wrist. But I still shot it, bro. And, like, at first, I did it one-handed. Knocked my wrist back. And then I went two-handed, bro. I was chasing him down the block. And then, like, we're going back to the hood. And, like, I'm over here just laughing, you know, like. And then they pulled up on us, bro. And, bro, they let off, like, I don't know, like, 8 shots on us. Just doom, 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 doom. So I still had one more shot. I just said, boom, and then I just hear the whole car. It's so loud. It sounds like a freaking bomb or something. At first, in the beginning, it was like, I don't know, it was an adrenaline rush. Like, I'd be so blind at the fact that I was getting sent off, you know? I was a walking send off, bro. Like, they'll send me and the shorties off because they didn't want to do it themselves. but they still want people to get shot. It's like at the end of the, like, think about it like this, like, all right, the neighborhood's a big house, bro, and there's a mom, and then you have a bunch of brothers, and each gang's a brother, you know? Each gang wants to be the man of the house. They want to be the man of the street. They want to be in charge. So the OGs send the shorties out to show them, like, don't f*** with us, you know what I'm saying? Like, we run the shit. And at first it was working, bro. Like, we only had two OGs. The rest were 15-year-olds. In the beginning, I had to ask for them, like, oh, can I hold it? But it got to a point where they're like, here, just hold this one. Keep this on you at all times. So I kept it on me. Bro, it was so beautiful, bro. Like, the barrel, all that was, like, charcoal gray, bro. I fell in love with that gun, bro. Like, I mean, I do feel bad for, like, certain people and the things I've done, you know, because, like, you know, my mentor told me, he's like, bro, think about the mothers, you know, think about the fathers, think about the brothers, sisters, kids, bro. You don't know what that person had, and you just took that from them. This is the way I tell people. When people ask me, why do people game, man? It's like, think about it like this. Police, school, and just basically society does not accept certain people. You know what I'm saying? They choose who they want. Gangs don't do that. They accept anybody, bro. Anybody. It don't matter if you're geeky or something. They're going to accept you, bro. That's the thing. A lot of people don't know how to do that. They don't know how to accept people. They don't know how to bring them in with open arms, you know? Everybody wants to just choose their own circle. Like, nah, gangs, they accept anybody, bro. It don't matter, you know what I'm saying? You're more than welcome. You're more than welcome to come home, bro.
Jaime spoke with WBEZ's Patrick Smith for this story. Tomorrow, we'll bring you one more story from their series. This one comes from Alex, who is currently awaiting trial for a gang shooting he was involved in back in November. That's tomorrow, here on The Takeaway. And we've been hearing from you about your own experiences with gun violence and how it's touched your life.
My name is Dion McGill. I'm coming from the West Loop. As a teacher, I taught in the south side of the city. Gun violence was a constant threat. A former student of mine and his brother were shot and killed last year. Another former student of mine shot and killed himself. My cousin's son was actually shot and killed in July of 2015 in a drive-by shooting. And I actually now work teaching gun violence prevention advocacy in schools. And it's a kind of a constant parade of shock, sadness, and sometimes sorrow. And, you know, as an educator, I often find myself wondering when the other shoe is going to drop and if some of the kids, you know, that you get to know and connect with will be hurt or even worse. I think we as Chicagoans, we've got to do more to deal with this problem. Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Protesters there on the streets blasting their government for financial mismanagement. But you're not listening to Caracas, Venezuela here. This is right here in America, in Puerto Rico, as part of May Day protests yesterday. Another deadline has come and gone in Puerto Rico's ongoing financial crisis. The government is now $73 billion in debt. Officials have been trying to keep creditors at bay. Meanwhile, strikers took to the streets, angry at the government's mismanagement and the possibility of more austerity measures. Here with more is Danica Cotto, reporter and editor for the Associated Press in Puerto Rico. Welcome, Danica.
Thank you for having me.
There is this deadline in front of people now. Is there any sense that some last-minute financing might stave off austerity?
It's hard to say. The deadline expired at midnight, and I spoke with the governor's spokeswoman early this morning after a lawsuit was actually filed, and she said that there's been no new reaction from the governor. They maintain, you know, that negotiations could still be going on, but one of the groups that represents bondholders that hold more than $16 billion worth of bonds filed a lawsuit already claiming, you know, that the government's actions to restructure the debt is unconstitutional.
Now that creditors, bondholders can legally get paid, what happens next?
Well, it's hard to say. Puerto Rico already faced about a dozen lawsuits prior to the litigation freeze that was imposed and, you know, that expired Tuesday at midnight. So now the government could either embrace a bankruptcy-like process and let a judge decide, you know, what amount bondholders would get paid, Or there might be, like you said, some last-minute negotiations with certain bondholders, and the remaining of the rest of the debt would be restructured via the courts.
And still, all of this legal wrangling, bankruptcy, bondholders, doesn't amount to much if you don't have a job and you're on food stamps all of a sudden in the streets of San Juan.
Correct. I mean, a lot of Puerto Ricans are very angry about what they feel is they're paying what the actions that the government took, you know, decades of borrowing billions of dollars to pay budget, to cover budget deficits. And so now Puerto Ricans in recent years have been hit with utility increases, new taxes. You know, the cost of living here to begin with prior to the crisis wasn't cheap, and now it's gotten more expensive. The sales tax is 11.5%, which is among the highest compared with any U.S. state. And now there's more austerity measures coming up. The governor recently approved a measure that allows his administration to reduce employee benefits, cut overtime, vacation days. There's new taxes on cigarettes. So people, especially those from the working class, feel that this is just piling on and piling on, and they're not getting any relief. And as a result of that, you know, in the past decade, about nearly 500,000 Puerto Ricans have gone to the U.S. mainland.
We're speaking with Donica Cotto of the Associated Press via Skype from San Juan, Puerto Rico. Donica, there was a deal in Congress last year to help shore up Puerto Rico's debt. It also added this control board to oversee all of this process. Has that control board just been unable to bring financial order, or was this whole situation out of their control to begin with and it was just a matter of time?
Well, actually, some feel that the control board stepped in a little bit too late, that it was created a little bit too late, but they have been taking a lot of action since it was created. They recently met on Friday, and they voted to allow themselves to hold an executive session and opt for Title III, which is, you know, the bankruptcy-like process, if needed. And prior to that, in late March, they approved a 10-year fiscal plan, which basically outlines the steps that Puerto Rico needs to take to stabilize its economy and cut costs. And in that fiscal plan, a lot of measures were considered. You know, one of them is implementing a furlough, cutting a public pension system by 10%, which that obviously created a huge outcry on the island. You know, the pension system is underfunded by more than $40 billion. And it's expected to run out of money by the end of this year. So many feel that the Federal Control Board is taking steps that the government, the local government, should have done a long time ago.
Danica Cotto, reporter and editor for AP via Skype in Puerto Rico. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Police on the streets of Istanbul fired rubber bullets and arrested 200 people after these clashes yesterday that you're hearing there. Meanwhile, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's crackdown continues. Last month, a referendum that helped Erdogan stay in office and expand his power. Now, nearly 4,000 civil servants have been purged from their jobs over the May Day weekend, and the government blocked its citizens' access to Wikipedia. Meanwhile, Erdogan has earned praise from President Donald Trump and is due to visit the White House in 2 weeks. Mihir Zainalov is chief editor of the Globe Post, and he says you can trace this crackdown to the failed coup of last year.
The crackdown in Turkey is so staggering that more than 140,000 people have been dismissed since the military coup attempt, while only, you know, maybe 1,000 or 2,000 people are directly involved in the coup. And that includes, you know, doctors, you know, baklava sellers, even soccer referees, you know, midwives, housewives, a lot of people from different, you know, walks of life that have no connection absolutely with the coup.
What's the advantage of blocking Wikipedia? It seems like such basic information on the internet. What's Erdogan afraid of here?
Well, it's not surprising that Turkish government is going after every website or everything on the internet that they deem as something that's defaming their image if there's any left. And they are basically blocking because there were several articles that said that Turkey had ties with ISIS. They asked Wikipedia to remove those articles, and when Wikipedia refused to do that, they shut it down completely until they remove it. When they remove it, they promised that they will reopen it.
And so this all seems like a strategy to divide and conquer civil society. You mentioned purges across the government, but also crackdowns on political groups all across the middle and the left in Turkey. This is widespread.
Exactly. The problem with Turkey is that whenever there is a crackdown on the opposition, President Erdogan is very successful because the opposition is so divided and he's exploiting those fault lines within the opposition to make sure that whenever he goes against one group, others will remain silent. And that was true in the media too. Whenever he went to one journalist or shut down one media outlet, others just cheered it because they thought that they would be the next. And eventually they were the next. And that's the reason why the Turkish opposition cannot come together and challenge the government.
Mihir, here at home, President Trump, of course, has pretty deep business interests in Turkey himself. He shocked a lot of people when he offered praise for Erdogan after the referendum last month that helped him consolidate his power there. Is President Trump's support for Erdogan perceived in Turkey? Do people on the streets have this sense that the Americans are on the side of the government here because of what President Trump said?
Well, it was surprising. You know, last summer when there was election campaign in the United States, President Erdogan actually blasted candidate Trump for being an Islamophobe. And when he saw that that there's a chance that he may win and the Clinton administration would be actually worse in terms of not supporting Turkey's policies in Syria and extraditing that Turkish cleric who is Erdogan's foe in Pennsylvania, they had this gambit to support President Trump. And whenever he was elected, Turkish government was so euphoric. But of course, broad segments of Turkish society do not support him. His favorability rating is so low in Turkey. President Erdogan will be entertained by President Trump at White House this month. This sends every kind of negative signals to Turkish dissidents, Turkish opposition back in Turkey, and also a very misleading message to President Erdogan. And President Erdogan will be here with three things on his agenda. One of them is he will ask the Trump administration to halt support for Syrian Kurds who are fighting against ISIS, and also hammer out some kind of a deal with an Iranian gold trader, Reza Zarrab, who bribed Turkish officials to bypass U.S.-led sanctions, who is sitting in a federal prison in Manhattan, and also extradite Turkish cleric Fethullah Gulen, who is accused of being the mastermind of the failed coup last summer.
Praise from America's president for Turkey's president amid a crackdown on political diversity, internet sites, and civil servants in Istanbul, protesters in the streets there. Mihir Zainalov, chief editor of the Globe Post, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have some sad news for all of you jam band fans out there. We say goodbye today to Colonel Bruce Hampton, a legend in the jam band music scene. Colonel Bruce died last night after collapsing during a performance in Atlanta.
Right now, let your Savior bless your soul right now. Don't you put off today for tomorrow. Tomorrow might never be. Let your Savior bless your soul right now.
In life, the Colonel played with and inspired tons of popular bands, including Fish, Widespread Panic, Modesky Martin and Wood, and Government Mule. He also led a bunch of other personal projects like the Aquarium Rescue Unit, Cold Talkers, and the Hampton Grease Band way back in the 60s. Colonel Bruce also helped launch the Horde Festival in the early 90s, and that propelled the jam scene into the mainstream.
Well, everything goes in cycles, and I feel we're at the end of a cycle, or I hope a beginning of a new one. And 1962 was the worst year of music ever, right before the Beatles and all the 60s renaissance happened. And so when it gets that bad, something changes. And I feel we're, right on the verge of something new coming. It has to.
That's Colonel Bruce on the Apparently This Matters show. He was respected for his guitar and vocal skills, but Colonel Bruce also had a thing for the weird and the irreverent. And that's largely why humor and gimmicks, stage antics, and just overall fun became an essential trait of so many jam bands. Here's Mike Gordon of Fish talking about the Colonel's many sit-ins with the band in a documentary called Basically Frightened.
He sat in. It wasn't clear whether he'd be playing guitar when he sat in with Fish, that is.
I was supposed to be doing a movie in Knoxville, and they were in town. They just said, come on and sit in. So I sat. I got a tape on set and read the paper.
It's time after 12 years of being in this band that I come clean.
Do you ever know that you're my hero?
So he was kind of taken aback a little bit, but he was he was right there with it.
Saturday morning, baby, broke my heart. Left me sitting in the dark crying.
It was a fitting death for the legendary jam musician. Last night, Colonel Bruce was playing at an all-star 70th birthday tribute to himself in Atlanta. He was surrounded by friends and improvisational luminaries. John Popper from Blues Traveler was there. So was Warren Haynes from the Allman Brothers Band. Fish's John Fishman was on stage, and many others. The finale was a jam on the Grateful Dead's Turn On Your Love Light. In the end, the Colonel collapsed and passed out over his own amplifier. A lot of the musicians on stage thought that in true Hampton fashion, that this was a joke, but they soon realized that something was wrong. Hampton was rushed to a local hospital, but his jam had ended. The Reverend Jeff Mosier was a longtime collaborator with Colonel Bruce. He wrote in a Facebook post, "He died here in Atlanta just a while ago. I feel so blessed to have been there tonight and to have been part of the greatest gathering of friends and loved ones. I've never seen Bruce happier. I've never been sadder. I've dreaded this day for years, but could have never imagined a more joyful departure." Colonel Bruce Hampton, dead at 70. Thanks for the music, Colonel. Good luck on your joyful departure.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.